cables were routed into the frame of the eye. Each of those cables, though it looked solid from a distance, was actually made of 16 more cables, and so on and so forth, down to a few fractal iterations. All of these ran parallel between the eye and cradle. Webbing them together was a network of smaller diagonal tendons, arranged so that if one cable broke, neighboring ones would take the force until a robot could be sent out to repair it. Cables broke all the time, because they'd been hit by bolides, or simply because they had aged out. And so if you squinted your eyes and looked closely enough at the tether, you could see that it was alive with robots. Some of these were the size of buildings and clambered up and down the largest cables simply to act as motherships for swarms of smaller robots that would actually affect the repairs. This had been going on, to a greater or lesser extent, for many centuries. The end of the cable had beanstalked downward from the eye, while the other had grown in the opposite direction, reaching out away from the habitat ring and from Earth, acting as a counterbalance. Cradle was much too small to be picked out at this distance. Even if it had been large enough to see, her view of it would have been blocked by the elevator, which was on its final approach, and expected to reach the terminal in about half an hour. It had a general resemblance to an old Earth wagon wheel, with 16 spokes reaching inward from its rim to a hotel-sized spherical hub where the people were. Watching it approach produced the mildly alarming illusion that it was going to come crashing through the dome. In that case, two domes would have been destroyed in the collision, since the hub was capped by a dome similar to this one, where passengers could relax on couches and gaze up at the view of the approaching eye and the habitat rings spreading out to either side of it. But of course it slowed down and stopped short of contact. Through the glass, now just a stone's throw away, she could see the new arrivals unbuckling their seatbelts, gathering their things, and floating toward the exits. Most of them were wearing military uniforms, or else the dark, well-designed clothing that she associated with commerçants and politicos. Not really her crowd. But Doc had invited her, which was all the credentials anyone really needed. Through the flimsy internal partitions, she could hear several dozen arrivals making their way to quarantine. These were eventually bound either for the Great Chain or the much smaller Taurus that encircled this end of the tether. Through the dome, she could see housekeeping robots and a few human staff making their sweep through the hub's lounge. After a few minutes, a green light came on above a door, and she joined a flow of a dozen departing passengers. Within minutes, she was ensconced in a small private cabin in the elevator's hub, where she would spend the four-day journey to the tether's opposite terminus. A chime warned her when the elevator began to accelerate downward, but it moved at a speed that was extremely modest by the normal standards of space travel, so she felt no need to strap in. She climbed into her bed and slept. The elevator was a hollow cylinder, 10 stories high, with a glass dome at each end, one aimed up at the eye and the other aimed down at Earth. The floors beneath those domes were made of glass, so that the light shone through from end to end. The outer walls were windowless and heavily shielded against cosmic radiation, but on the inside, the cabins and lounges had windows under the atrium. Or at least the more expensive cabins did. Cath 2's was at the periphery, hard up against the outer wall, with no windows other than a tiny porthole onto a ring-shaped corridor. Which was fine with her. At the beginning of the journey, they were in near weightlessness, but as the days went on, gravity would increase, reaching one normal G at cradle. She could tell when she woke up that she had not slept for long, since gravity was still quite faint, perhaps comparable to what had once existed on the moon. She wandered up and down the atrium, looking for a place where she could sit and read her book. Several bars and restaurants fronted on it, but these were not places for Cath, too, as she could tell just from the look of the people and the prices quoted on the menus. Comfy-looking chairs and couches were distributed around the glass floor of the atrium, and a coffee bar stood along one edge, so she ended up there. After an hour or so, Belad Tomov turned up and sat in her general vicinity, but made no move to interrupt her reading. When she came to a good stopping place, she looked up and happened to notice Ariane Casablancova sitting on the opposite side of the atrium, working on a tablet. So they had 5 of the 7, Doc, Memmi, Ariane, Bellad, and Kath too. The only 2 missing were the Dynan and, somewhat more problematically, the Aiden. Kath too and Bellad ran into Doc and Memmi later when they wordlessly agreed to go to the least expensive of the eateries and get some food. Somewhat uncharacteristically, Doc was not surrounded by students, scholars, and terraform bigwigs. He was just sitting at one end of the room, carefully eating soup. Memmi was at his elbow, reaching in frequently to tuck his napkin back into his collar. Neither of them reacted when Kath Tu and Bellad took seats at the same table, but after a few minutes, Doc said,
"Lieutenant Tomov, it is good to see you again. Greetings."
And the 2 of them exchanged salutes in their respective racial styles. Lieutenant, obviously, was a military and not a survey rank, and so this confirmed the unsurprising fact that Bellad's relationship to survey was, at best, ambiguous. Much more interesting was the fact that he and Doc had already met.
"I hope that this assignment will not prove an inconvenience," Doc continued.
"All duty is inconvenient to a greater or lesser degree, or it would not be duty."
"I was thinking more of the advancement of your career, Lieutenant. In your future dossier, this will stand out as a highly anomalous episode. Depending on who is reading that dossier, it might help or hurt you."
"I don't concern myself with such matters," Bellad returned.
"Some would call that unwise, but I tend not to favor the company as such. You, on the other hand, will do nicely."
"May I ask why I was so honored?"
Doc's eyes moved briefly to Kath, too.
"Kath here will be worried that it's because she shared an indiscretion with you, drew you into it. Or perhaps she is a little bit exasperated with you for having passed it on in your report."
Kath, too, shook her head no, but did not wish to interrupt Doc. Bellad, however, seemed to take it in. Doc continued.
"None of that really counted. You are a known quantity now, not only to me, but also to Kath, too, and to Ariane, which is somewhat useful. But even without all of that, you would have been a fine choice. Not everything must be for a reason. Never mind what our Julian friends say."
He had noticed Ariane Kasablankova approaching them, somewhat tentatively, with a tray of food. He made an almost subliminal gesture with his eyes toward Memmi, who stood up and fetched an extra chair from an adjoining table. Ariane joined them. Kath, too, felt vaguely uncomfortable. A day earlier, this woman had held and wielded power over her, had known things about her that would normally have been private matters. What was she to Kath, too, now? Presumably an equal member of the 7. Ariane had, of course, worked this all out ahead of time, and prepared for it.
"Kath Tu and Bellad," she said. "Our first meetings were in a formal bureaucratic setting that now leads to some awkward feelings. I look forward to reacquainting myself with both of you as a colleague."
"Noted," said Bellad.
"Thank you," said Kath Tu.
But if anything, she felt even more awkward now. Ariane's little speech had not been delivered warmly. More like she was ticking her way down a checklist. In that vein, she now turned her searchlight eyes toward the other 2.
"Doctor Who? Remembrance?"
"Doc,"
Doc said.
"And Memmi."
"It is good to make your acquaintances in person."
These formal and somewhat chilly conversational gambits led nowhere, and so after an awkward silence, Ariane tucked into her meal.
"Doc," Kath Tu said. "May we know what the hell we are doing? What is this 7 for?"
"It looks like a 5 to me,"
Doc said puckishly, somewhat breaking the tension. From Memmi, Ariane, and Bellad had all aimed sharp looks at Kath Tu, startled by the informal way in which she had just spoken to her old professor. Doc, who clearly didn't care, continued,
"When we are 7, which will be in a few days, on Cradle, then I will explain at once to everyone at the same time.
Fair enough, Cath-2 said. What should we be doing in the meantime?
All of the things you will look back on fondly later, when you have not been able to do them for a long time.
It was a lovely thought. Cath-2 tried to be duly appreciative of the generous sentiment behind it during the remainder of the journey. But nothing of the sort really happened. She read more than she had intended to of the books she had acquired on the Great Chain. At meals and in the recreation center, she placed herself in Belid's eyeline, just in case he was in the mood. But things were different now. Their time together in the queue had been an ideal setup for a relationship of a casual and temporary nature. It had never gone beyond sleeping in the same bed, but it might have. The knowledge that they would probably never see each other again had made it easy to shack up for a couple of nights and enjoy each other's company in a way that would have posed too many complications had they been working together. Now they were working together. Belid had wisely pulled back. She understood and considered a certain amount of sexual frustration an acceptable price to pay for being prudent. She had two meals with Ariane, and in her spare time she made desultory attempts to learn more about the Julian from network searches. Cath-2 assumed that all such search activity was being monitored and logged by someone, possibly someone who was in touch with Ariane through whatever agency Ariane worked for. As time went by, Cath-2 was less and less certain that that was actually quarantine. Or perhaps another way of saying it was that quarantine's public face, the people who talked to you when you were traveling between space habitats, was only one avatar of something that had to be much bigger and more complicated. In the same way that survey and military were different things, and yet drawing a sharp line between them could be difficult, so it was with police and quarantine. And once you broadened the scope to include police, you were talking about other things besides routine law and order work. At some level, intelligence and counterintelligence were under that umbrella. Cath-2 had no way of guessing where Ariane fit into that system. Searching the network too avidly for personal details about Ariane Casablancova would have been noticed, and would have been a bad idea. Not searching at all would almost have been more suspicious. So Cath-2 searched a little, and found less. Low-level Q officers might be mentioned on the network from time to time, as the result of a police report or public relations initiative, but there was nothing of the sort for Ariane, assuming that this was even her real name. A compulsion for privacy was hardly unusual for a Julian living and working in blue. The Julian part of the ring, centered on the Tokomaru habitat, was the least populous of the 8 segments. 95% of it lay on the red side of the turnpike. Only a tiny sprinkling of habitats projected east of Kiribati into the blue zone, and in those the Julians had been diluted by the more numerous and aggressive Teclans, whose segment lay just on the far side of the Hawaii Boneyard. Thus, the Julians had maintained enough of a presence in blue that they could live and work in it without being seen as aliens or immigrants. Many of them were duhos, playing approximately the same role in modern society as priests had done pre-Zero. The destruction of Old Earth and the reduction of the human population to 8 had done for the idea that there was a god, at least in any sense remotely similar to how most pre-Zero believers had conceived of him. Thousands of years had passed before anyone, even in the most remote outposts of human settlement, had dared to suggest that religion, in anything like its traditional sense, might be or ought to be revived. In its place, a new set of thoughtways had grown up under the general heading of Duch, a Russian word referring to the human spirit. Duch-based institutions had developed under the general term of kupol, a word that harked back to the glass bubble that had served as a kind of interfaith chapel and meditation room on endurance. Modern-day kupols all traced their origins back to that structure, which Dubois Harris had called the woo-woo pod. When people nowadays watched scenes from the epic that took place in it, they were in the backs of their minds thinking of their local kupols and the people who staffed them. A professional member of a kupol's staff was generally called a duho, a truncation of the Russian word duchobor, meaning one who wrestled with spiritual matters. Coupoles, like churches of old, were supported by contributions from their members. Some, as on the Great Chain, were richly endowed, magnificent buildings. Others, like the one in the queue, were just quiet rooms where people could go to think or to seek help from what amounted to social workers. Ducos tended to trace their lineage back to Louisa, who had played a similar role during the epic, and some of the better educated ones drew explicit connections between their coupoles and the Ethical Culture Society, where Louisa had gone to school in New York. But Louisa, of course, had not produced a race. The Duco profession had ended up being dominated by Julians. The Julian habitat of Astrakhan, which hovered anomalously in the middle of the dine-in segment, had become a sort of hothouse for the production of Ducos of various denominations. Kath, too, was able to establish that Arion had originated from there, but little else. It was fine. There were ample reasons for Arion to keep to herself and lead a quiet life. Most of the giant nickel-iron moon core fragment, named Cleft, had been melted down and reshaped into what was now the eye. The engineers had not been able to bring themselves, however, to destroy the part of it immediately surrounding the place where Endurance had come to rest at the end of the big ride, and where the bodies of Doob, Zeke Peterson, and other heroes of the epic had been interred directly into iron catacombs. That patch of the asteroid, the deep, shielded declivity where the first several generations of the new human races had lived out their entire lives, had come to be known as Cradle. Everyone had, of course, seen the chapter from the epic, where Doob had gone out on his last spacewalk with Eve Dinah, looked up at the walls of iron rising from the valley floor, and foreseen that one day a ceiling of glass would be built over the top, turning the Vale of the Eves into a huge greenhouse, where children would be able to float about unencumbered by spacesuits, eating fresh greens from terraced gardens. It was probably the biggest tearjerker in the whole epic, and a perennial favorite. All of Doob's predictions had, of course, come true. Cradle had ended up supporting a population of several thousand, until later generations had been obliged to push outward. Cradle's main defect had been a lack of simulated gravity, which had obliged those early generations to construct what amounted to glorified merry-go-rounds, on which children could take turns being centrifuged in order to foster bone growth. Subsequent habitats, spinning Tori, mounted to the walls of the cleft, had actually been more crowded and confined than Izzy itself, and many generations had lived cramped lives in them with only occasional opportunities for R&R in Cradle's sunny, open volumes. In time, they had learned to make bigger and better habitats, and Cradle had been abandoned for many centuries, an occasional destination for historians or curiosity seekers. The construction of the Eye had, in effect, cut Cradle and its immediate surroundings loose from Cleft, and it had drifted in a boneyard for a while until the decision had been made to give it a new purpose. The original greenhouse, which was a wreck by that point, had been replaced by a new, bigger, retractable cover. The underside had been planed flat. The canyon walls had been terraced back, making them less steep, and not incidentally creating valuable, buildable real estate. A nickel-iron yoke had been arched over the whole thing so that it could be attached to the bottom end of the 36,000-kilometer tether that dangled from the eye. The icon in the transit station, two hills enclosed by a bubble, was a simplified depiction of what Cradle actually looked like. Its total inhabitable footprint was a circular zone about 2,000 meters in diameter, which put it on about the same scale as downtown Boston or the City of London. This was cleaved by the Vale of the Eaves, whose walls had once been nearly vertical. Now this was true only of the bottommost 10 meters or so, a slot that snaked through the bottom of the town like a gully. It became a rust-brown river when there was heavy rain, and so they had maintained an island in the middle of the stream, exactly on the site where Endurance had touched down. Once, it had been possible to go there and touch the little nubs of steel where Eve Dinah had welded the ship into place. These, however, had since been protected under glass domes so that they would not rust or get worn away by tourists' fingers. The ship itself was long gone, of course, The survivors had begun dismantling it almost as soon as they had arrived, and what little they hadn't used was radioactive waste, long since shipped away to carefully tended locations in boneyards. It was therefore a city constructed on two dizzyingly steep hills that faced each other across a crevasse. A kilometer-long bridge, celebrated for its grace, arched across the gulf between the hills, a plunging wedge of air flocculent with grizzled crows. It was a city of compounds. Some of these dated back to the early days of its construction, when the bubble had not yet been completed, and there had been a need to make smaller inflatable domes over certain areas. Others had been built in imitation of those first ones. Neither the compounds, which for structural reasons tended to be circular, nor the overall topography lent themselves to a grid street pattern. Consequently, the map was a chaos of switchbacks and meanders and streets that turned suddenly into stairways or tunnels. Limitations on building height led people to dig down into the underlying metal, rather than building upward, and so most of the city's square footage was hidden. The buildings were like icebergs, larger below than above. Above grade, stone was a popular building material. Older and less prestigious buildings used the synthetic rock known as moonstone, made from pieces of Earth's former satellite. Newer and nicer buildings were made from marble, granite, or other rock quarried from the surface of the Earth itself. For the one resource that was the shattered surface of Earth had been able to produce in abundance, and even before it had been an atmosphere, had been rocks. The city thus presented a hard face to pedestrians in its narrow streets. Those granted access to compounds would, however, find themselves in fragrant gardens under the shade of trees. Since Cradle was confined to the equator, green things grew there so luxuriantly that they had to be kept in check by hordes of little grabs with pruning bill hands. Atop each of the hills was a park. Rising above one of those parks was a roundish domed building called the Capitol. Rising above the other was a squarish pillared colonnade called the Change, short for the Exchange. At the time Cath 2 and the other passengers arrived, Cradle was dangling 2,000 meters above the waters of the Atlantic Ocean, being dragged due west toward where the equator cut across the reshaped coastline of South America. This movement reflected the fact that 36,000 kilometers above it, the eye was traversing the habitat ring westward, or Casfon, clockwise as seen from over the North Pole. Being nothing more than a weight on the end of a long string, Cradle always followed the movements of the eye. The city's dome was open, with its baffles raised to reduce the wind blast. It was balmy and humid. This was almost always true on the equator, but altitude and the brisk movement of the air made it pleasant enough. The smell of that air, redolent of salt and iodine and marine life, was proof irrefutable that Cath 2 was back in the atmosphere of New Earth. It was an artificial atmosphere. The human races had bombarded the parched and dead surface of the planet with comet cores for hundreds of years just to bring the sea level up to where they wanted it. Then they had infected that water with organisms genetically engineered to produce the balance of gases needed to support life, and, having done that, to commit suicide, so that their biomass could be used as nutrients for the next wave of atmosphere-building creatures. According to their measurements, the result was a nearly perfect reproduction of old Earth's atmosphere. No one who breathed it after a lifetime spent in habitats needed scientific data to back that up. Its smell penetrated to some ancient part of the brain, triggering instincts that must go all the way back to hominid ancestors living on the shores of Africa millions of years ago. As she knew from having traveled to Earth many times, it was a kind of intoxicant. It was the best drug in the universe. It made people want to be on Earth more than anything. It was the reason that Cradle, which was bathed in that air, being dragged through it all the time on the end of its 36,000-kilometer string, was the most exclusive community in existence. And it was the reason that Red and Blue had twice gone to war over the right to live on the surface. Cradle was hung from the end of the tether by a sort of bucket handle that arched high above the middle of the city. The bucket handle was hollow, accommodating a surprisingly ramshackle elevator system that took Cath 2 and some other passengers down to a platform embedded in the city's bedrock, or bed metal, along its northern limb. From there, a ramp took them up into the streets of the city itself. The tops of the walls all around the exit were white with crow shit. Hundreds of birds were perched where they could view the faces of those emerging into the light and swoop down to deliver messages to ones they had recognized. Other new arrivals stretched their hands out to offer little snacks. A well-dressed Ivan man, bustling along ahead of Cath 2, quickly attracted a grizzled crow by that strategy. With his other hand, he held out a little tablet that, as Cath 2 knew, must be showing someone's photograph. "Coffee at the Change, dot 17," the man said. The crow gulped the snack down in a move that looked almost like vomiting in reverse, then flapped away, screaming the same words into the ether. Other grizzled crows, not hungry or not currently on errands, were keeping up a raucous murmur that, if you listened to it, might give you clues as to what was going on in the equities market or the political world. At first, the new arrivals moved together in a pack, visibly distinct from the ordinary foot traffic of the place, but within a few hundred meters, this had dispersed, and Cath, too, found herself alone, no different from anyone else. She knew the general layout from school books. She had arrived on the north side, Change Hill. Perhaps a native would have known as much just from the attire of the people, the way they walked. These were commerçants, working by day in subterranean offices, ascending to the surface for meals, recreation, and other means of enjoying their wealth. Commerce was, of course, spread all about the Habitat Ring, and the old centers of Greenwich, Rio, Baghdad, et al. Had financial hubs that rivaled, and in some ways eclipsed, Change Hill. But nothing could ever compete with this place for prestige. The wealthiest and most powerful financiers, the up-and-coming traders in places like Greenwich, no matter how well they were doing for themselves, were forever haunted by the thought that they might be missing something on Cradle. Because so much of that activity was taking place below the surface, the streetscape of Change Hill was deceptively quiet, a little like an old Spanish city during siesta. Soon lost, and resigned to the fact that doing so would make her look like a tourist, Cath 2 took the piece of paper out of her pocket and reminded herself of the address. She already knew it was on the south side and that she would either have to cross the bridge, which was clearly visible, arcing high above the city, or descend all the way to the floor of the vale and cross the gully at its bottom. The latter tempted her, but she knew that she would want to spend a lot of time there, looking at the place where Endurance had touched down and where Eve Dinah had walked with Dubois Harris. That was best saved for later. So she climbed, winding her way through the streets, which were paved with a stone whose reddish-brown color hid the rust stains that streaked down from every exposed bit of bedmetal. She cut across the park beside the Change, where young traders in good clothes, out on snack breaks, were sitting on benches prodding their tablets, or sprawled in clusters on the grass laughing, or playing lawn sports with colored balls. The bridge's northern end met the park's edge. From far below, the bridge had looked slender and graceful, belying what she now understood was its real bulk. Here it broadened to form a massive connection with Change Hill. Even at its apogee, however, it was broad enough for 20 people to walk abreast. After turning around one last time to admire the marble columns of the Change and to hear the roar of voices within, she faced south and began to ascend. In the early going, the bridge was a stairway, but as the arch gradually flattened with height, it turned into a ramp, faced in white marble, broken with occasional landings. She had been informed that the real reason for these was to prevent wheeled objects from going fully out of control. If so, that purpose had been artfully concealed by turning them into little sculpture gardens where bridge climbers could pause for refreshment beneath rose-covered bowers. While not immune to such temptations, Cath, too, was at bottom a serious walker who did not like to stop once she had gotten going. She was thinking, reviewing in her mind the journey on the elevator, which had been largely uneventful. This, as she had gradually realized, was a part of its charm, end of its exclusivity. It was possible to reach Credo quickly, if you had enough money to charter, or authority to commandeer, the right vehicles. Most people use the elevator, though. Thus, Credo was separated from the rest of the human world, not so much by distance as by time. Spending that much time was a sort of luxury, afforded only to a few. Of course, passengers worked en route. This explained all of those expensive restaurants and bars around the atrium with their private meeting rooms. But Kath, too, hadn't had any real work to do. She had gone for long hours without talking to another human at all, and she had done a lot of reading and watching of entertainment on screens. She had slept normally, confirming that any epigenetic shift that might have gotten started last week had been aborted. All of this just made her want to reach the meeting place so that she could at least have an explanation from Doc, meet the missing Dinan and Aiden, and get started on whatever it was the Seven was supposed to be doing. She maintained a brisk pace to the top of the arch, but there permitted herself a few minutes' pause. At the apex, the walkway broadened into a scenic overlook, affectionately known as Hurricane Heights. The wind was so powerful here that it made her eyes water. She turned her back to it and toddled carefully over to the eastern railing on the lee side. She blinked her vision clear and allowed herself a few minutes gawking down into the compounds and the streets and the Vale. The sun was setting behind her. Since they were on the equator, it would set quickly. The Vale was already in shadow, but the stone walls of the compounds and the fronts of the buildings were emanating a magical pink-gold glow. Lights were coming in on windows along purple-shaded streets. It was a real place. Not like the artificial environments of the Habitat Ring. Some of the larger habitats came close to possessing this quality, the sense that you were in something close to a real planetary environment. But it was always dispelled as soon as you looked up and saw the opposite side of the habitat hanging a few kilometers above your head. Here you could look up and see endless sky, the stars coming out, the gleaming necklace of the habitat ring rising perpendicularly from the eastern horizon. The thing that made it real was the air, the sheer quantity of it, the endless variety of its movements and its smells. She wished she had a glider so that she could go dancing in it. According to a legend that was almost certainly incorrect, the overlook where Cath-2 was standing, the center of the bridge, was the location where Eve Dinah's demolition charge had exploded after she had made her choice and tossed it into space. The compromise that Dinah had forced by placing that bomb against the window of the banana had seemed elegant and straightforward for about as long as it had taken for the bomb to go off. In one sense, the gaming of the system had begun even before it was thought of, when Eve Julia had pointed out that she would have few babies, and Eve Aida had prophesied that she would have many. It had not taken long for the other Eves to make similar calculations. As Arkies, picked in the casting of lots, Camilla and Aida were younger than the others, with 2 to 3 decades of fertility ahead of them. If they decided to become baby factories, and if they were lucky, each of them could conceivably bear as many as 20 children before menopause. Dinah, Ivy, Moira, and Tekla, all in their early 30s, might bear a few each. Roughly speaking, therefore, those 4 had as much combined childbearing power, if you wanted to think about it that way, as the younger pair of Camilla and Aida. Julia, as she had pointed out, would be lucky to bear 1 child before menopause. And she had not needed Dube to explain the exponential math. The Julians were going to be swamped. They were going to be mere curiosities. People in the distant future, coming home from work, would exclaim to their partners, "You'll never guess what I saw today, an honest-to-God Julian." Those were the mathematical rudiments of the new great game, and the roots of much of what had happened since then. The preponderance of later historical scholarship suggested that most of the Eves didn't know that they were playing a game until they were a few years into it. Aida, based on what she had said in her curse, might have been the exception to that rule. But decisions made about one's children were the most personal decisions that one could make, and no mother of sound mind would have admitted to herself, at the time, that she was playing a sort of game vis-à-vis the other mothers. In a way, it would have been simpler had they gone about it more cold-bloodedly. Consciously or not, the seven Eves sorted themselves into four, two, and one. The four were Dinah, Ivy, Tekla, and Moira. The two were Camilla and Aida. Arithmetic suggested that the descendants of the four would be about as numerous as those of the two. Existing friendships and affinities already linked the four and created an unspoken compact, not articulated until they were long dead, to the effect that their children would embody complementary qualities. Dinans, in a sense, did not have to be complete humans as long as Ivans were around to do some of the things they weren't as good at. This was a blunt way of saying it, which was why it went unsaid for a long time. But hundreds of years later, the descendants of the four could look back and see that it had always been so. By that time, it was so deeply ingrained in their DNA and their cultures that there was no going back. The two, by contrast, had no natural affinity with each other and no existing relationship. Camilla and Aida had not met until shortly before the Council of the Seven Eves. All that they shared, and it wasn't much to go on, was an aversion to Julia. Both of them had, at one point or another, fallen under Julia's spell only to be disappointed by her. In Camilla's case, the seduction had happened during a White House dinner. For her part, Aida had been talked by Julia into joining the swarm, only to end up leading the rebel faction that had deposed and mutilated her. Given the way that had all turned out, it was of course unlikely that Camilla, or anyone of sound mind, would consciously align herself with Aida. And yet the mathematics of the four and the two created a kind of gravity, invisibly drawing her that way. The breach that had opened between Camilla and Dinah during the Council of the Seven Eves would not be forgotten. Considered more calmly, Camilla's words had a persuasive power that couldn't be denied. It simply was the case that their descendants would be living bottled up in confined spaces for many generations to come. As Louisa had demonstrated through her research, and as the people of the Cloud Ark had just finished proving in spectacular fashion, it wasn't a good way for normal, unaltered humans to live. If the survival of the human race depended on rewiring their brains to make them better at such a lifestyle, then perhaps they had best get on with it. In a way, that decision had been taken out of their hands by Camilla, who had made her choice clear and only needed to work out the details with Moira. She had, in effect, made the first clear move in the great genetic game. And contrary to her own stated principles, it was, in a way, the most aggressive move possible. She had let them know that her descendants, who were likely to be quite numerous, would get along just fine in the conditions they would all be facing for the first 10, 20, or 100 generations. The other six were left to follow her lead or to react against it. Dinah, Ivy, and Tekla, in essence, reacted against it, with Moira eventually making another choice. But the historical fact was that Moira's descendants had, more often than not, been part of the block of the four. Aida had played the game more overtly. This had basically consisted of waiting the others out to see what they would do, and then making countermoves. The other Eves decided early, and stuck with those decisions. All of Dinah's children, she ended up having five of them, were recognizably of a type. The same was true of Ivy's three, and Tekla's six. Julia only got to choose once. Camilla's 16 offspring varied from one to the next, as she tinkered with her decisions based on behaviors she was observing among her first children. But she had never wavered from the general template that she had laid out during the Council of the Seven Eves. Aida's seven children, however, were all different. Exactly what she was thinking was known only to Moira, the keeper of secrets, the mother of races. For the other Eves told Moira what they wanted in confidence, and she took those confidences to her grave. But it was plain enough, and in any event, it became the accepted version of history, that the first five children of Aida had been conceived as reactions to what other Eves, all except Moira, were doing. Aida's stance toward the others had been well articulated in the curse. She knew that the other six Eves would always loathe her personally, and that this feeling would inevitably be transferred to her offspring. Human nature being what it was, Dynan children, thousands of years from now, would be throwing rocks at Aiden children on playgrounds and making jokes about cannibalism. They would never be assimilated into the society descended from the Four. Therefore, to the extent that Dinah was making choices about the virtues that her offspring would embody, and thereby making a move in the game, Aida sought a countermove, which might consist of conceiving a child that would be like Dinah's, except more so. Or of inventing an anti-Dinan, a type of human uniquely suited to exploiting the weaknesses in the Dinan type. Thus, the first five children of Aida. She had, however, been unable to employ the same strategy vis-a-vis Moira, for the basic reason that Moira knew exactly what Aida was doing, down to the specific DNA base pairs that had been altered in her ova. If this were a game, then Eve Moira always had the last move. The failures of her first eight pregnancies had only deepened the mystery. Since she had never articulated her choice, no one really knew what she had done, which made Moirans an enigmatic race, not only to the other races, but to themselves. But it was plainly the case that Moirans were the only race capable of going epi. Kath II's genome, like that of every other life form, was fixed. A copy of it lived in every cell in her body. But which of those genes were being expressed at a given time, and which were lying dormant, was changeable to a degree far beyond what humans were normally capable of. It would have amounted to a kind of superpower, had there been a way to control it. But certain hoary old legends to the contrary, there wasn't. Kath II never knew when she might fall asleep for a week and wake up a different person named Kath III. Sometimes the results were brilliant. Rarely they were fatal. Sometimes they were inconvenient, or downright embarrassing. Most of the latter cases had something to do with what happened, like it or not, when a Moiran fell in love. In any case, this was the choice that Eve Moira had made, and the gift she had conferred on her daughter, Cantabrigia. And it was assumed that she had done so because she believed that this degree of plasticity would somehow bring the world back into balance against the choices that Aida had been making. Julia, the One, looked to make the best of a bad situation by endowing her offspring with qualities that would make them useful and important in spite of much smaller numbers. She had already expressed, during the Council of the Seven Eves, the idea that there was real value in the ability to envision possible futures. And she had linked it to leadership, or failing that, to the ability to give useful advice to leaders. When that trait ran out of control and sought dark paths, it led to depression, paranoia, and other forms of mental illness. The challenge then was to find a way of combining that trait with a more positive mentality. Julia's research, and she did a lot of research, therefore tended to center on the history of sages, seers, ecstatics, shamans, artists, depressives, and paranoiacs throughout history, and the extent to which those traits could be localized to specific base pairs in their genomes and fostered by acculturation. Historians had come along much later and developed their own vocabulary for telling the story of the succeeding 5,000 years. The first pregnancies were called gestations. Not counting the numerous miscarriages, there had been 39 of them, distributed among the seven Eves, before Camilla, the last to stop bearing children, had finally gone through menopause. From these, 35 viable girls had resulted. 32 had gone on to have children of their own. By then, Eve Moira had figured out how to synthesize Y chromosomes, and so some of the second generation had been male. The result, therefore, had been 32 strains. Each of the seven new races had embodied more than one strain. The strains were recognizably different, and yet clearly classifiable as belonging to one race or another, somewhat as East Africans differed from West Africans, but still looked like Africans to Europeans. Correction was the name given to the phase that had begun after the first round of gestations, when Eve Moira had fixed errors that had led to several non-viable infants. In a sense, Correction went on continuously, all through the first round of gestations, and began to taper off as the daughters of the Eves began to produce second-generation children. It faded into a next stage, stabilization, which lasted through the following 10 generations or so, as Y chromosomes were patched up, lingering genetic mistakes were fixed, and members of different strains began to interbreed to produce hybrids within their own racial groups. During this time, the lessons of the black-footed ferret were put to use, as various techniques were employed to increase heterozygosity. In truth, a vast library of human genetic sequences was available in digital form, and once they had survived the first few generations in cradle and trained hundreds of bright young people to be genetic engineers, they could, in theory, have resequenced the original human race from scratch. This was the sort of thing Eve Moira had done by synthesizing the first artificial Y chromosome. But it was not what they collectively chose to do. That choice was altogether cultural, not scientific. Decisions had been made in the Council of the Seven Eves. Races had been founded that were, by then, several generations old. They had begun to develop their own distinctive cultures. To undo those decisions by reverting to the rootstock human race was viewed almost as a kind of auto-genocide. The competition that had developed among the different races rendered it unthinkable. So the genetic records of rootstock humanity were put to work adding a healthy degree of heterozygosity back into the existing races, rather than trying to go backward. Thus, stabilization, which had continued until about the 12th generation, at which point even the Julian race had grown large enough to go on propagating through normal means without the need for lab-based adjustments. Stabilization had blended into propagation, the next phase generally recognized by historians, which was fairly self-explanatory. The descendants of the Seven Eves had continued to have sex with each other and make more babies. This had occupied much of the first half of the first millennium and led to a condition of overcrowding so severe that it had made obligatory the formation of separate colonies away from cradle. For there were other places, perhaps not quite so favored as Cleft, but still well suited for the building of new habitats. They had reached the point, by then, of being able to construct new machines for moving about in space. It was time. Or so insisted the descendants of the Four, who sensed that conditions had become inimical to them in the crowded precincts of Cradle. Camilla had been frank about her strategy of making new humans well suited to life in confined spaces. She had succeeded in doing so. And once the early habitats of Cradle had grown crowded, her strategy had begun to look like a good one. Whether it was purely an expression of their own racial mythologies or a biological necessity, the Four had reached out and pioneered new habitats, at first in other locations on Cleft, later on other fragments of Peach Pit. The descendants of Aida had done likewise, sometimes cohabitating with the Four, more often going it alone. It wasn't so much that Aida had done things that couldn't be undone, as that she had said things that couldn't be unsaid. In that sense, her curse had real effect. An individual Aiden of the second millennium was the product of a mixed-race culture that was more than 1,000 years old. He or she had grown up with persons of all races, loving some and hating others, getting on well perhaps with certain Teclans and Moirans, while getting into fights with certain Aidens. In terms of his or her own personal experiences, there was no reason to stick together with others of the same race. But each race did have an ineradicable narrative, by now encoded into a culture that had become ancient. The narrative of the Aiedans was that their Eve had spawned not just one race, but a race of races, a mosaic, as proof that her children could do all that those of the other Eves could, and more. And if you were a descendant of Aida, clearly endowed with genetic markers that she had chosen for that purpose, then the inexorable force of that narrative would drive you toward colonies populated largely or purely by other Aiedans. As the Aiedans were less numerous than the descendants of the Four, their second millennium colonies had tended to be smaller and more Spartan, leading to a symbiotic relationship with the Camites, who tended to thrive in such environments. Aiedans built colonies, but Camites made them work. In any case, The formation of new colonies and habitats during the second millennium had led to a phase that the historians called isolation. The formation of racially pure populations. Isolation led to caricaturization, selective breeding, pursued consciously in some cases and unconsciously in others, that had the effect over many generations of intensifying racial differences. The example cited most often was a gradual change in eye color among Moirans. Eve Moira's eyes had been hazel, relatively light in color by the standards of black people, but not all that unusual. By the end of the second millennium, many Moirans had eyes so pale in color as to appear golden in strong light. On the walls of the great chain's fashion stores, blown up to 10 times life size, Moiran fashion models still gazed at you through shockingly yellow, cat-like eyes. Because pale eyes had been a distinctive characteristic of Eve Moira, it had become thought of as beautiful and desirable, and Moirans with pale eyes had found it easier to mate and reproduce, intensifying the trait over time, to the point of caricature. Kath Tu herself, no model, was frequently complimented on the lightness of her eyes, which were closer to green than yellow. But modern, appearance-conscious Moirans were frequently startled when they saw photographs of their Eve with her eyes that were merely greenish-brown. The shift in Moiran eye color was obvious and easily documented, but the same thing, mutatis mutandis, had happened with scores of other phenotypes among all the races. Selective mating had the power to wreak impressive changes over time without any artificial meddling. In some cases, though, racial isolates had acquired genetic labs of their own. These had been used for many purposes, usually considered benign. In some cases, they had been used for enhancement, which meant deliberate genetic manipulation for the purpose of rendering racial characteristics more pronounced, the artificial acceleration of what was happening naturally in the way of caricaturization. Sometimes this led to freaks, monsters, and disasters. But often it worked, and when its results mated within isolated groups, those isolates became more and more pronounced embodiments of their races. The end result of all this tended to be non-viable populations, clearly identifiable as inbred. So as often as isolation, caricaturization, and enhancement had taken root and run their courses, they had led either to extinction of colonies or to an ameliorative process called cosmopolitanization, wherein formerly isolated groups had re-emerged with their long-lost cousins of the same race and bred back in the direction of healthy and sustainable hybridized strains. Not surprisingly, cosmopolitanization had flourished as the habitat ring had been formed during the most recent millennium, suddenly creating a vast amount of new living space far more appealing than the cramped, dark torii in which people had been living for the last 4,000 years. The isolates, some of whom hadn't been heard from for centuries, some of whom could not even speak Angliski, as the Russian-inflected English, now shared by essentially all humans, was called, emerged from their holes and recombined with their extended families in a population explosion the likes of which had not been seen since old Earth's 20th century. Most of the population of most of the races had thus converged on a set of renormalized racial profiles, while preserving a few extreme tribal isolate strains, variously treasured, feared, or persecuted by others of the same race. Or at least, that was how it was in Blue. Red had exhibited the same general trends among its Aiden mosaic, its hundreds of millions of Camites, and the roughly 80% of Julians who had decided to throw in their lot with Red. The current state of affairs between the turnpikes could only be speculated at, since no communication, other than stray signals intelligence and a propaganda channel that most people ignored, had been received from that part of the habitat ring for almost 200 years. For a few minutes, the last light of the sun had been striking spires, statues, and carved stonework on the fronts of some fantastic old cupoles mounted to the seemingly vertical cliff before her, the flank of Capitol Hill. But then suddenly it was near dark. Kath Tu turned, accepting the wind blast on her right side, and descended the south limb of the bridge. As much as she loved the power of the air, she felt herself scurrying the last few steps to get down into the shelter of the buildings. Capitol Hill was higher than Change Hill, and so, rather than debouching into a park, as it did on its north end, the bridge here stabbed into the flank of the slope. Cath, too, was plunged directly into a snarl of streets that were but indifferently illuminated by light spilling from occasional doorways and lamps that the owners of some compounds had decided to mount along the tops of their walls. The streetscape of Bordeaux draped over the topography of Rio de Janeiro was how the city had been described by its designer, a Julian Moiran breed who had been born more than 4,000 years after both of those cities had been annihilated. She had a device in her pocket that knew her exact lat long. Those numbers were, of course, useless in a city that was being dragged through the air on the end of a rope. Her reluctance to pull the thing out and look at it, however, went deeper than that. Being here had plunged her into a sort of reverie, nonetheless compelling for being obviously the product of fantasy, namely, that she was walking around in a city on old Earth. She didn't want to spoil it until she was well and truly lost. So she let her feet take her through the red stone streets, trying to go uphill as much as she went downhill, using the towers of some great old cupoles as landmarks, when unsure of herself, circling back toward the abutment of the bridge. For she had been told that the meeting place was not far from the bridge. She might have asked for directions, but the temperature had dropped. The glittering arc of the habitat ring had been obscured by high clouds, and it had begun to rain, a hissing curtain of small, warm drops. Pedestrians had all disappeared into wherever it was they knew to go. She'd been warned that Capitol Hill was deserted after dark. This seemed doubly true when a storm was brewing. Several times she had passed by the front of the same building, or seen it from down the length of a street, for it stood at a place where several ways angled together into a cramped asterisk of wet cobblestones, and so sudden views of it kept jumping into her peripheral vision as she ambled along the nearby alleys. That intersection was there because of a house-sized block of stone that jutted from the hillside and forced all the nearby streets to stretch around it. The stone, as she could guess, was a crumb of the moon's mantle that had become embedded in its iron core. It might have been in there for a billion years, or it might have been a loose bolide that had slammed into red-hot Peach Pit shortly after zero and gotten stuck in the congealing metal. Cleft and its siblings had many of those. They were usually treated as impurities in the melt. This one had been left in situ, presenting a rugged gray face to the streets that wrapped around it. Atop it, 10 meters above street level, someone had constructed a round stone tower. Fanning out behind, like a ship's hull behind its jutting prow, was a triangular building that she could guess had a nice compound in its center. The third or fourth time Cath 2 saw this tower, it was from a distance of perhaps 100 meters. She was gazing at it straight down one of those narrow streets. On its upper story, it had a row of arched windows looking out in all directions. Warm light was shining out of those windows, and she could see people sitting at tables, drinking and talking and eating and reading. All of those activities sounded good to her, and she entertained a hope that it might be some kind of public house, not a private club. The entrance was not obvious, but she found it around to the right side, where a mouse hole had been cut into the metal matrix in which the rock was embedded. The tunnel angled upward and curled around, becoming a spiral stair partly obstructed by rusticles the size of small trees. Actual candles burned in niches. One turn of the helix took her out of the metal and into the stone. Two took her to an arch-topped door of real wood, unmarked except for a wrought metal door knocker in the shape of a bird with a heavy, curved beak. Hand-forged feathers of black iron and palladium made it grizzled. Through the door she could feel warmth and hear conversation. She reached for the knocker, unsure yet whether the place was meant to be public or private. Then suddenly she was conscious of the scrap of paper in her hand. She stretched it out under the light of the nearest candle. The Crow's Nest, South Cradle. She pushed open the door and entered. The first thing that came into her view was a semicircular bar of old copper, a row of tap handles, a window behind looking into a busy kitchen. Music came out of a back room, not so loud as to interfere with conversation, but enough to make her nod her head slightly with its beat. She didn't recognize the style, but she knew the type. Something that had been cooked up by people isolated in a mining colony or an early habitat. People who knew how to dance. Tending bar was a healthy-looking dine-in man in his 40s. He seemed not to know that he was quite handsome. He was polishing a glass while scanning a piece of paper with handwritten numbers on it, a bar tab. Standing there alone, facing outward at the sweep of windows with its astonishing view of Cradle, he looked like the captain of an old Earth ship. A few moments after she had entered, neither so soon as to make her feel conspicuous, nor so late as to make her feel neglected, he looked up at her and raised his eyebrows slightly. Or perhaps eyebrow was better, since, as she now saw, one side of his face had taken serious damage. "What are you drinking, Katha Moltsova too?" The original gnats had been developed in the workshops of Arjuna Expeditions in Seattle and launched into space shortly before Zero, where they had crawled around on the surface of Amalthea under the eye of Eve Dinah. Later, during the first 2 years of the epic, the original design had been modified to work on and in ice. Every child knew the story of how such gnats had been used, first to bring Ymir to rendezvous with Izzy, then to merge those two objects into Endurance. As such, gnats resonated more strongly in blue culture than in red, but they were used on both sides of the turnpikes. Or to be more precise, both cultures used a vast family tree of species and subspecies of gnat, all descended from the first Arjuna model and all sharing, to a greater or lesser degree, the code base originally created by programmers like Lars Hodemaker and Eve Dinah. The number of different uses to which gnats and swarms thereof had been put over the millennia was uncountable. They were as ubiquitous and various as hammers and knives had been pre-Zero. Like hammers and knives, they could be used for constructive or destructive purposes. In the latter category was a whole taxonomy of gnats designed to be projected at high speed out of gun-like devices. Most of these were designed to fold up into a compact form, like a dart or bullet, so that they could be accommodated in magazines, bandoliers, and the like, and fed into the breaches of firing mechanisms. Only a single gun, in the sense of a traditional pre-Zero firearm, had survived the hard rain and found its way to Cleft. This was, of course, the revolver that Julia had removed from Pete Starling's shoulder holster and secreted on her person until the moment when she had attempted to shoot Tekla with it. Camilla had interceded, probably saving Tekla's life, and suffered burns that had left her scarred and in pain for the remainder of her days. Later, the same weapon had fallen into the hands of Aida. She had issued it to a member of her band who had fired the last bullet from the last gun to kill Steve Lake. The weapon was now in the collection of the Historical Museum on the Great Chain. Whether and how it was put on public display was a reliable barometer of the state of red-blue relations. Since the metalworking technology needed to make new guns had also been destroyed, and since many generations had passed on Cleft before anyone had even conceived a need for gun-like objects, the entire armaments industry, when it had finally gotten rebooted, had done so from a clean slate. The results owed more to tasers, several of which had made their way to Cleft, than to traditional firearms. The latter had been designed to project a dumb lump of metal at high speed and been optimized over time to deliver high rates of fire. But spraying dumb lumps of metal around the cramped interior of a space habitat was not a good fit for any use that could be conceived of by the engineers, who, hundreds of years after the arrival on Cleft, began to think once again about how to make projectile weapons. During the intervening centuries, violence had generally been a matter of grappling, punching, and the use of hand weapons such as metal rods, with really dangerous stuff like knives and swords used only in a few cases by people who had gone well off the political or psychological rails. The first new projectile weapons were made specifically for use against those. The maximum range was perhaps 10 meters, so the projectiles didn't have to travel with high velocity. They had to be smart in the sense that if they missed the target, if they struck anything that was not a human being, they should become as non-destructive as possible. This generally meant that they would deploy what amounted to tiny drag chutes and slow themselves down as quickly as possible while preparing to fragment against, as opposed to penetrating, whatever they hit. On the other hand, any projectile fortunate enough to reach its target should try to do something useful, which generally meant incapacitating, injuring, or killing it. Clearly, all of these decisions were well above the pay grade of dumb lumps of metal, and so gnats were used instead. These were not as dense as lead, so they had a low ballistic coefficient and could not travel very far. Again, however, in the context of a space habitat, this was a good thing. After a sort of dark age during which the cleft colony had lacked the resources needed to advance the art of robotics and contented themselves with fixing and making copies of the original models, new engineering resources had begun going into this branch of technology. The bolder programmers were daring to meddle with code files that had last been checked in by Eve Dinah. Mechanical engineers were figuring out how to reboot ancient CAD software and examine the digital blueprints created by Lars. Their initial efforts were fairly simple, such as making a gnat that would automatically throw out a drag chute after it had traveled a certain distance without hitting anything. More effort went into the projectors than the projectiles. Police and military users tended to be Teklins, whose Anglicky contained more Russian loan words than that of other races, and borrowed many characters from the Cyrillic alphabet. Catapult was their preferred term for the device that threw the projectile gnats. They shortened it to various affectionate terms, such as cat and Katya. The second half of the word, polt, seemed to have a connection to polya, pronounced with a long U, as in pool, which was the Russian word for bullet. After a brief, awkward phase of trying to combine the term gnat with pulia in various ways, meaning something like bullet robot, they had just settled for pulia, which was sufficiently precise in a universe that no longer included any actual old-school bullets. Other words from the antediluvian gun world made it through unchanged, such as shoot and shot, but officers giving the command to shoot tended now to say pull, recalling what skeet and trap shooters had once called out when they wanted a clay pigeon to be thrown. Use of the term pulia without any modification tended to irritate knowledgeable interlocutors in exactly the same way as pre-zero gun nuts had reacted to lay persons who used the word bullet. This reflected the fact that pulias came in an even vaster range of sizes and types than old-school ammo. There were only so many things that could be done with a lump of lead. A far wider range of options lay open to the pulia engineer. An alternative term, ambot, was also used. This was all context-dependent. Grunts, who tended to see these things as necessary burdens to be hauled around in bulk, loaded into cats, unjammed from firing mechanisms, etc., tended to use pulia, but once the projectile had actually been fired and begun to execute its program, it tended to be called an ambot. When speaking of bulk supplies, people would say botmo, in the same way that ammo had been used on old Earth. The sort of person who needed to be shot at by the authorities because he or she was committing violence, or threatening to, with edged weapons, was unlikely to submit meekly to advances in the technologies used to enforce civil order. Directly, they began to develop countermeasures, which, of course, then needed to be surmounted by the engineers in turn. If an ambot, for example, could be fooled into believing that it had missed its target or struck something that was not a human, it could be rendered nearly harmless. Camouflage changed its purpose from fooling the human eye to fooling the electronic brains of ambots. Armor was no longer made to stop extremely fast pieces of lead. Its purpose now was to protect the wearer from the invasive strivings of ambots. Warriors became living, moving fortresses under siege of multiple ambots that often used swarm tactics to find a way inside before their batteries ran down. The old tactical calculus of projectile warfare changed in other ways, too. Catapults and botmo that had been captured by the enemy, or that had simply fallen to the floor and been picked up, could be rendered inert and useless by digital means. Some of them would try to find their way back to their masters, and so battle zones in which a lot of botmo had been expended tended to look as though they were infested by army ants, as spent ambots attempted to swarm back toward the combatants who had fired them. In any event, the authorities had enjoyed a monopoly over the production and use of such weapons until sometime in the second millennium, when the number of widely separated habitats and resulting political fragmentation led to a situation in which the civil authorities from Habitat A might actually have cause to shoot at those of Habitat B. The number of different types of catapults and ambots and of the defensive measures used against them exploded. No complete catalog of types had existed for thousands of years. Here and there, one might stumble across a museum display in which a few dozen or even a few hundred types of ambots had been rendered inert and mounted to a wall with explanatory plaques beneath them, explaining in what millennium they had been invented, by whom, and in which habitat they had been used to prosecute this or that disturbance. But everyone knew implicitly that such displays only included samples that had at random made their way into a particular collector's drawer. Disturbance was used a lot more often than war, even for relatively large events such as the conflicts that had occurred over the last few centuries between red and blue. Because space habitats were so vulnerable, prosecuting an actual war in the sense of a 20th century old Earth total war was unthinkable. Nuclear weapons had not been reinvented because there was no need for them. A rock thrown across the ring at a space habitat would kill as many people as a hydrogen bomb. The same strategic calculus therefore applied as on old Earth during and after the Cold War, namely that on no account would red and blue risk actual open war with each other, but that many small conflicts could happen in places where they might be passed off by the majority of the news-reading populace as too minor to worry about. The only two conflicts that were denoted, in retrospect, as wars, were ones that had taken place the old-fashioned way, on the surface of the planet. The War on the Rocks, 4878 to 4895, and the War in the Woods, 4980 to 4985. When Cath 2 walked into the crow's nest and was greeted by the Dynan with a damaged face, it was 5003, so about 20 years after the high water mark of the War in the Woods. The Dynan looked to be about 40 years old. The scars on his face had been there for a long time. "One of those," she said, nodding at a nearby tap handle adorned with a handwritten label identifying it as cider.
"Coming right up," he said. "Since I have you at a disadvantage, my name's Ty Lake."
"Short for Tycho, or?"
"Tayuratam. Bit of a mouthful."
His accent was that of an indigen, so from this brief exchange, she was able to surmise quite a bit about his history. His parents had probably been Sooners, which was to say, people who had been so eager to escape from the settled life of space habitats that they had found ways of getting down to the surface of New Earth, just as soon as the terraform had rendered it marginally inhabitable. Doing so was a violation of First Treaty, which had ended the War on the Rocks a few decades earlier, and so it was discouraged. Comings and goings from the bigger and older habitats of the ring were easily monitored by the authorities, and so Sooners tended to depart from liminal zones on the edges of boneyards and near the two turnpikes. On the blue side, Dynans were strongly overrepresented among Sooners. Teklans tended to be the cop-like authorities, given responsibility for chasing them down and breaking up their human smuggling rings, leading to stereotypical depictions in popular culture of Dynans as charismatic pirates and Teklans as humorless straight arrows. Or at least that had been the case until the Sooners' transgressions had led to the War in the Woods, in which the predominantly Teklan armed forces had been obliged to rescue many Dynan adventurers. Depictions nowadays were a little more nuanced and made the older ones seem campy. Thus, Cath 2 could reasonably guess that Ty's parents had been Sooners and had established themselves on the surface long enough to have at least one native-born son. The connection back to Boneyards meant that Sooners tended to be people with a certain amount of skill in making things, and so many of the early Sooner communities had been soundly constructed on an engineering level, even if their political culture had been a little on the rough and ready side. Ty, presumably, had grown up in that environment and found himself, in his late teens or early 20s, embroiled in the war in the woods. Some ambot of some type, no point in worrying about the details, had found its way through his armor, assuming he was even wearing any, and done damage to his face. This was the sort of thing ambots tended to be good at. In combat, it was frequently more useful to disable than to kill, and so ambots fought like chimpanzees, aiming for the face, the hands, and the genitals. Faces were easy to recognize and hard to spoof, so those were a favored target. Tai might have suffered these injuries in many different circumstances, e.g. a red-on-blue raid between two rival Sooner communities, but there was something about his posture and his manners that suggested a connection to the military, and so she guessed he had been officially recruited to fight for the blue side and suffered his injury in a straight-up battle between organized military formations. He obviously ran this place. This was clear from the way he was treated by staff and customers alike. In and of itself, it wasn't unusual for a retired veteran to open a bar. That was so normal as to border on stereotype. It was a little less easy to explain how such a person could end up in control of this particular bit of real estate, which was probably worth more than some entire space habitats. The brand name on the tap handle, combined with the fact that it was handwritten, both implied that this beverage had been produced from apples plucked from trees growing in the soil of New Earth. Under the terms of Second Treaty, which had terminated the war in the woods, the only people allowed to live on the surface and do things like tend orchards were the descendants of Sooners, now renamed Indigens. The fact of this cider's being on tap here proved, or else was a very well-crafted marketing campaign intended to create the impression, that Tai Lake maintained close connections with at least one Indigen community, and that he was importing its produce directly from its registered Indigen zone, or RIZ. This made it a desirable luxury good, since most food was produced, far more cheaply and reliably, in habitats. Drinking beverages or eating food produced in a RIZ was for wealthy connoisseurs. Perhaps to allay any concerns Cath 2 might be having on that score, Tai said, "On the house," as he set the glass on its coaster. "That is kind of you," Cath 2 said, as her eyes strayed to the black slate above the bar and noticed a shocking figure quoted in the way of price.
"On the contrary," Tai said, "normal courtesy for a fellow member of my seven."
So, Tyura Tom Lake was there dining. It made sense, if the seven was going to be doing anything on the surface, anything that might involve a RIZ.
"You're a bit early," Tai said. "Some of the others are here."
He tossed his head back. This looked like one of those bars that went on forever, rambling into annexes and back rooms in a way that no architect would countenance, unless they were a very sly architect indeed. So, she inferred he was making a reference to some kind of back room or snuggery that she would never be able to find on her own.
"Came up the back way," he added.
"There's a back way?"
"There's always a back way."
"Doc?"
"Showed up half an hour ago."
For the most important living architect of the terraform to walk into the front door of a crowded bar on Capitol Hill would be to create all manner of unnecessary distractions. Doc would be recognized. People would want to demonstrate how important they were by walking up to him and introducing or reintroducing themselves. It would become tiresome, and it would wear him out. People would talk about it, perhaps even to the point of fouling up whatever mission the Seven was being organized for. Of course Doc had used the back way.
"Anyone else?" she asked.
"Besides the nurse? Just the big fella."
So Bellet had arrived too. Or so she guessed until several minutes later, when Bellet walked in through the same door that Cath 2 had used. He looked around the place in a manner that made it obvious he had never been here before. Quickly he picked out Cath 2's face. He did not react, but moved toward her directly. Cath 2 had taken the last available bar stool, but Bellet cut through the crowd, which was easy for him since people tended to get out of his way, and stood behind her, close enough that she could feel his warmth on her back. He ordered a popular brand of inexpensive beer from another member of the staff. A breed, probably Camite Julian, female, somewhat exotic. Ty had drifted away and resumed whatever he'd been doing with the bar tab. Kath, too, checked her timepiece and guessed that Ty was getting ready to clock out so that he could take them back to the room where they would have the meeting. As the woman behind the bar handed the beer from her tiny hand into Bellad's huge mitt, Kath, too, pivoted toward him, tinked her glass against his, and said, "To the seven." Bellad was busy for a moment thanking the barmaid in somewhat over-formal style, but then nodded and joined Kath, too, in a drink. Kath, too, explained what she knew of Tyuratam Lake, and Bellad spent the next several minutes appraising the dine-in from a distance, drawing who-knew-what conclusions. Presently, Ty finished his paperwork and slipped around the corner of the bar, catching Kath Tu's eye as he did so. She could see that for him to extract himself from the society of the crow's nest was no insignificant thing, since many knew him and wanted to say hello. But he seemed to have learned a sort of posture and gait that made him look too busy to brook interruption. Kath, too, found it hard to keep up with Ty's meandering course through the various rooms and corridors, and ended up allowing Bellad to step in front of her so that he could break trail. Because Bellad was much taller and wider than she was, this made it difficult for her to see what was ahead of them. But at length, she became conscious of being in a long, downsloping corridor with a stone floor and stone walls paneled over with wood to make them seem warmer. Various doors led off of it, but one stood at the end, and this Ty opened for them. She saw warm light spilling out, glancing off the polished rock between Bellad's legs and the wood paneling around his shoulders. "Welcome to the bolt hole," Ty said. Kath, too, followed Bellad into the room and then collided with his backside, bouncing off him and taking a step back. He had come to a dead stop upon entering and dropped into a slight crouch, one foot ahead of the other, and pointed straight ahead. Sidling around him, Kath, too, followed his gaze, and his toes azimuth, across the room. The bolt hole was a cozy little place, with an oval table just big enough for seven. Doc was seated nearest the door, flanked by Memmi and by his robot. Across from him was Ariane Casablancova. Seated at the far end of the table, facing the door, was the man that Ty must have meant when he had spoken of the big fella. Because of his position behind the table, all that was visible were his head, shoulders, and arms. The arms seemed long and quite heavily constructed. What really drew attention, though, was the architecture of the big fella's skull. His head looked like the head that a normal person's head would develop into if they kept growing beyond adulthood into some more pronounced phase of development. Thick reddish-brown eyebrows did little to conceal a prominent ridge of bone above the eyes. When Kath, too, first saw him, he was draining a pint glass, which looked even smaller in his hand than it had in Bellad's, but when he set it down to expose the lower half of his clean-shaven face, she saw the set of his jaw and the size of his teeth, and understood that the seventh member of the seven was not just any Aiden, but a Neoander. Eve Aida had founded seven strains over the course of 13 separate pregnancies. The failure rate had been so high because the alterations she had demanded from Eve Moira had been so extreme. She had been willing to accept some unsuccessful pregnancies, given that she saw herself as having plenty of time until menopause, compared to all the other Eves save Camilla. And Camilla she did not see as a competitor, given that Camilla wanted to raise a race of people who were not inclined to compete with anyone. The Eves, confined to a small volume of inhabitable space on Cleft for the remainder of their lives, were impoverished in many ways. Of information, however, they had an inexhaustible wealth. Essentially every document that had ever been digitized was available to them, at least until such time as the memory chips on which it was all archived began to fail, a decay that had begun on a small scale, but that would take decades to have any serious effect. Aida began to research human genetics. To the extent that her genome was the final expression of a long historical process, a dense and cryptic encoding of everything that her ancestors had learned by managing to survive long enough to reproduce. This meant learning about the history of human evolution as well. Her genome, like that of all the other Arkis, had been sequenced and evaluated before she had left Earth. A copy of the report had been provided to her. It contained information as to what parts of the world her ancestors had come from. Much of this was what you would expect for an Italian woman, but there were details she hadn't known, such as some genetic connections to North African Jews, to an isolated tribe in the Caucasus, and to the Nordic peoples. Based on certain genetic markers, it was also clear that, like many Europeans, she was part Neanderthal. Later analysis by historical scholars of the breadcrumb trails left by Aida in computer logs suggested that she had spent almost as much time studying the genomes of the four, whom she saw as her direct competitors, as her own. And of the four, she spent as much time learning about Moira's genome as Dinah's, Tekla's, and Ivy's combined. This was because Moira was of African descent, and Aida had become fascinated by the idea that Africans carried more genetic diversity within their genomes than non-Africans, as a simple result of the fact that humanity had originated on that continent and spread outward. Non-African races had been founded by isolated groups of adventurers. Breeding among themselves, they had created gene pools that were necessarily limited to what they had brought with them, only a subset of what was to be found in Africa. This idea had been used to explain, for example, why Africa contained both the tallest and the most diminutive people in the world, and why so many top athletes were African. It wasn't because they were naturally better athletes, but because the bell-shaped curve of random genetic variation was wider. For every African who was a great athlete, there was presumably another who was miserably uncoordinated, but no one paid any notice to the latter. Whether or not this was a valid theory, the fact was that Aida swallowed it hook, line, and sinker, and used it to inform her genetic strategy in the great game. And to the extent that the four bothered to develop counter-strategies, they had to take it into account. The very existence of Moirans as a race was a result. Rather than try to follow all of Aida's machinations in detail, base pair for base pair, Eve Moira had chosen to tinker with those aspects of the genome that controlled epigenetics, making her children into Swiss Army knives. Tekla had been an easier target, where Aida was concerned, since she had stated so forthrightly what she considered desirable in a future race. It was easy enough to see that the children of Tekla were going to be strong, disciplined, formidable fighters. And one did not have to be a military genius to understand that fighting, for the foreseeable future, several millennia of being bottled up in space colonies, was going to be up close and personal. To the extent that violence was going to be an ongoing factor in human history, it was going to be a style of violence that relied on size, strength, and toughness. If history was any guide, those best at violence might end up ruling over everyone else. Aida was not about to see her children dominated by the sons and daughters of Tekla. She might simply have done what Tekla did, and created versions of herself modified for certain traits associated with athleticism. Instead, having become fascinated by the odd detail in her genetic report, she had embarked on a program to reawaken the Neanderthal DNA that, or so she imagined, had been slumbering in her and her ancestors' nuclei for tens of thousands of years. It was a somewhat insane idea, and in any case, she didn't have enough Neanderthal in her to make it feasible, but she did produce a race of people with vaguely Neanderthal-like features, and in later centuries, the process of caricaturization, isolation, and enhancement, which had affected all the races to some extent, had wrought especially pronounced changes on this subrace. Gene sequences taken from the toe of an actual Neanderthal skeleton found on Old Earth and sequenced before Zero were put to use. Old Earth paleontology journals had been data mined for stats on bone length and muscle attachment so that those could be hard-coded into the Neoander wetware. The man sitting at the end of the table was the artificial product of breeding and genetic engineering, but had he been sent back in time to prehistoric Europe, he would have been indistinguishable, at least in his outward appearance, from genuine Neanderthals. The creation of the new race had happened incrementally, over centuries. By the time Neoanders existed, it was too late to bother with the trifling ethical question of whether it was really a good thing to have created them. During their slow differentiation from the other races, they had developed a history and a culture of their own, of which they were as proud as any other ethnic group. Not surprisingly, much of that history was about their relationship with Teklans, which was, as foreordained, largely combative. At its most simple-minded and stupidly reductionist bones, the Teklan side of the story was that Neoanders were dangerous ape-men, brought into existence by a crazy Eve as a curse upon the other six races. The Neoander side had it that Teklans were what Hitler would have produced if he'd had genetic engineering labs, and that it was a damned good thing that Eve Aida had had the foresight to produce a countervailing force of earthy, warm, but immensely strong and dangerous protectors. Much of this combative relationship had become irrelevant, as the tactical landscape had become dominated by catapults and ambots, and physical strength had become less important to the outcome of fights. But the old primordial animus remained, and explained why Belid's immediate response, upon entering a room that contained a Neoander, was to make himself ready for hand-to-hand combat. Doc chose to ignore this. "If he even notices," Kath Tu thought, but she was pretty sure Doc noticed everything.
"Belid? Kath? I do not believe you have met Langobard."
It was a fairly common Aiden name.
"Bard for short," Langobard offered.
"Langobard, may I present Belid Tomov and Kath Amalfova too?"
Bard rose to his full height, which was not all that impressive, while performing the Aiden version of the salute, which was done with both hands. He then reached out across a seemingly impossible distance with his right, offering to shake. Belid was still reluctant to move, and so Kath too stepped forward and extended her hand. She had never made physical contact before with a Neoander. Even in Red, they had become somewhat scarce, as many of the existing population had moved down to New Earth to become indigens. In Blue, they were rarely seen at all. Langobard took her hand with elaborate delicacy, swallowing it up in a meat paw with fingers the size of baby arms, and giving it the gentlest of squeezes. He was clean-shaven and carefully groomed, wearing a good suit of clothes that actually fit, prompting her to wonder where such a person would find a tailor. He had a slightly bemused look on his face, as if he knew what she was thinking.
"Charmed," he said,
with a little nod that only emphasized the size and mass of his head. And after she had nodded back, he released her hand, no worse for the wear, and stretched it out toward Belid.
"Lieutenant Tomov, pleasure to meet you. What's it going to be? Punch in the face, handshake, or a big warm hug?"
He swung his hand back while extending the other arm, displaying a wingspan much greater than his height, as though offering to embrace Belid across the table. This at least broke the tension enough that Belid finally collected himself into a less minatory posture, saluted, and extended his hand in return. The Teklan's hand gripped the Neoander's just a few centimeters away from Kath Tu's face. She could hear the knuckles cracking as they tested each other's strength. Standing on the far side of this spectacle was Ty, watching it with an expression that was not all that easy to read, given that the damaged side of his face was toward her. But she thought she detected a certain level of wry amusement, perhaps a little dampened by awe. Ty caught Kath Tu looking, then shook his head and snorted.
"I hope I didn't overdress," Bard remarked, after he and Belid had finally let go of each other without incident. "I sometimes overcompensate when I come to Cradle." "Is that often?" Ty asked.
Kath Tu understood that Bard's remark had been a conversational gambit, and not just a bald assertion. Ty, with the social reflexes of a dine-in bartender, had recognized it as such and was already following up.
"It's actually surprising that you and I have never crossed paths before," Bard said, addressing Ty but watching Kath Tu out of the corner of his eye.
Only after she had sat down in one of the available chairs did he resume his seat.
He picked up the empty glass.
I noted on your drinks list that you sell her some surface produce. Thank you for the beer, by the way.
You're most welcome, Ty said.
I have spent most of my life on the surface, Bard explained, where some members of my clan grow grapes. We produce wine. Our primary market is restaurants in Cradle, though we do ship a few cases up to private sellers on the Great Chain.
Well then, that's one explanation for our not having met, Ty said. Kath, too, interpreted this to mean the Crow's Nest generally doesn't stock such high-end wine. But Bard got a sly look on his face and, after a moment, returned.
Did you have another possible explanation in mind, Ty?
Where is your clan's vineyard? Bella demanded. Then, in a belated attempt to soften it, he added,
If you don't mind. Oh, it's not a secret, Bard said. Antimer, just near the line of demarcation.